he's everywhere, Carol said. He's not just here. I looked up from my coffee and took a moment to listen to the nearby conversation. Really? Greg asked. I thought he was just something people here made up. No, she answered. Mr. Tatler goes way, way back, and it just depends on where you are. So in fast food places, they say he lives in the deep fat fryer, but generally people say he lives somewhere high risk. So around here, he lives in the boxes and the high shelves. The story changes a lot, but the message is the same. Be careful. Don't put your hand in broken machine parts. Don't try cleaning the fryer without supervision. Be careful what you take down from the shelves. Oh, so it's like a safety thing. Yeah, Carol answered. It's to discourage newbies from grabbing random boxes without looking at the labels. Do you know how many injuries we get because some idiot tries taking a set of weights down from the high shelf thinking it was a box full of blankets? I thought it was just a good way to prank new people, Greg mused. Well, there's that too, Carol smirked. Do you remember when Alec over there lost his watch? Both faces turned to me. I think at this stage I was supposed to laugh, but I remembered the event vividly, and I didn't find it funny. It was just that the whole floor had roared at me with laughter, and it wasn't even the sense of total helplessness I felt when I realized my supervisor, who up until then had been completely supportive, was in on the joke. It was just that when I'd grabbed the watch and pulled up, something had caught my hand and it felt like someone was in there pulling me down. And for a brief moment in time, I believed in Mr. Tatler. And I believed he'd come for me and no one was going to help me. Hilarious, I groaned. Didn't they have to send you home for the day? Greg asked, nearly choking with laughter. I thought back to the feeling of what had grabbed me. It was cold, but nothing like steel or plastic. It had felt wet, soft to the touch, but unnaturally strong. Images of rotting hands and cadaverous bones popped into my head. I really did think something was in there and was going to pull me in. Even worse, I'd seen it. For just a brief moment, I'd seen something down there, moving amongst all the dingy, forgotten machinery.
I can see him, Greg cried out laughing, imitating me on my first day. I can see Mr. Tatler, he's got me.
The two of them were beside themselves with laughter. One for the ages, I grunted, before getting up and walking away from the lunchroom. I quickly left, leaving half my lunch uneaten. I'd been working in a supervisory position for years by that point, and hadn't been on the warehouse floor as a worker for a long time. I spend most of my days watching cameras and reporting people for misconduct. It's very 1984, and means I'm alone most of the time. And yet, I still couldn't escape the humiliation I'd felt on my first day. By the time I settled at my workstation, a dark mood had come over me, and even as I tried to focus on my work, it lingered in unpleasant ways. For the first hour or so, nothing happened, and yet the shadows on the camera feed looked darker. The space around me felt emptier and lonelier than usual, and I found myself struggling to concentrate. I told myself it was just because I was tired, but I kept imagining that feeling of being grabbed on the first day. It was so bad, I'd even jumped when I first sat down. All I could do, though, was to keep scanning the monitors, and eventually, I came across the unusual sight of a man standing perfectly still over an empty conveyor belt. How old was this guy? I wondered. In his 60s? Once again, the machines had failed and nothing had appeared. A quick search in the system showed that that guy was on the 13th hour of a 12-hour shift, and I realized that his mind must have been mush. He didn't even move in response to the broken machine. He just swayed a little. I reached out, getting ready to report him for disciplinary action, when the old man finally looked up. Like a drunk looking for the door, he shuffled around before walking off towards some shelving units nearby. There, he turned the corner and... Damn it, I groaned, before cycling through every camera,
so that I could try find them again. But none of the monitors covered that space. It was just a tight corridor between two enormous ceiling-high shelves filled top to bottom with boxes of every shape and size. I figured he might have been smoking or even going in for a nap, but without the cameras I couldn't see. I decided I'd just have to sit back and wait to see if he emerged. Except, he never did. I kept checking back for the next few hours, but the space where he'd worked was always empty. Eventually, I called an amnesty worker and asked them to go check. But a few moments later, they radioed back and told me there was nothing down there. I must have explained it to them another 100 times. They were wrong, I told them. There was no way for him to leave. He had to be down there. I checked the tapes. They showed him entering, but never leaving. I was told, politely but firmly, to go check for myself if I was so sure. So, that's what I did. I waited till the end of my shift and went down there. By that point in the day, things had started to die down a little. People arriving for night shift aren't exactly the chattiest of customers, and there's a sullen atmosphere that keeps everything kind of muted. In fact, I've always hated walking through the floor to get home at night. Everyone there feels damn close to offing themselves, and the way they look at me sends shivers down my spine. When I finally found the old man's workstation, I saw the empty space he'd stood over, and something about it seemed oddly uncanny. At the time, he'd been alone, and that whole corner of the warehouse was deserted when I arrived. I didn't like that one bit, and I wondered if I was going to force myself to stay for much longer. The warehouse is a building so big you can't even see the end of it. Rows and rows of thousands of shelves, all stacked to the very top with boxes and crates. I hate the feel of grit and dusty concrete beneath my shoes, and the buzzing fluorescence struggled to light the ground from so high up, turning into a gloomy place filled with gloomy people. It's a labyrinthian city of busy workers, half-broken robots, and endless darkened corners, casting soft-edged shadows that hurt the eyes. Close by, I'd found the corner where he'd turned, but there was nothing there. At least, nothing that I could see. It was a dark alleyway between two shelving units with very little light. Images of the poor old man lying there, half dead from a heart attack, hidden by shadow, came into my mind, so I decided to take a closer look. As I took the first few steps into the claustrophobic corridor, the sound of distant work and machinery faded into the background. As I passed gaps in the walls around me, shadows crossed my face and danced in thick bands. Without knowing why, my heart began to thunder. I hated feeling that scared, but I remembered the way everyone was laughing at lunch, the way they'd laughed on my first day, and I forced myself to keep going. There was nothing to fear, I told myself, over and over. Eventually, I reached the very end and saw that the shelves were pushed against the wall with no easy way to squirrel through. Either the old man had disappeared into thin air, or he'd climbed out, or tunneled out, or God knows what. Whatever the explanation was, I decided I could think about it elsewhere. I turned, getting ready to go home, when I saw a box standing alone in the middle of the floor, between me and the exit. I jumped at the sight of it. I had been alone the whole time, and it hadn't been there when I'd first come down. There hadn't been so much as a whisper, and yet, there it was. A box as big as a fridge, something I couldn't have missed. I approached it and tried to push, but the damn thing was too heavy for one person. I had to squeeze past, force myself to lean my entire weight against it just to get enough room to go past. The smell of it was awful, like a mixture of ammonia and sewage, and it reached so far up into my nose I felt the hair on my neck stand on end. Thankfully, I found someone close by to help me go back and sort it out. You can't leave obstructions on the floor, no matter where, because of how much the warehouse relies on robots for cleaning. So together, this guy and I went back down the corridor, his face screwing up from the smell, and I told him to get ready for just how damn heavy this thing was. Except, he reached out and effortlessly moved it along the ground. The empty cardboard inching easily against the gritty floor. He briefly looked at me like I was an idiot. "It's empty." "I know," I snapped, before reaching up and opening the top flap. "But it wasn't before." I grimaced when I pulled my hand back. Something greasy and orange, the color of used cooking oil, was left on my fingers from handling the lid. With room to air, the smell within the box multiplied 1,000 times and hit us both like a brick. The guy beside me started to retch, and it took me a good few minutes to even be able to look inside. When I did, I saw a nest of shredded, half-chewed gunk, looking a bit like a wasp's nest, or maybe even the kind of thing a hamster might make. It was big though, bigger than your typical dog breed, and large parts of the pulp had been soaked in rusty brown fluid that smelled like copper, since dried to a flaky crust. And there were scratches all around the side of the box, long horizontal ones, but all irregular in length and size. It took all our willpower to handle the thing and clean it up without being sick, and for a few days afterwards, there were rumors of someone squatting in the warehouse, which I know for sure didn't come from me. After that, I started having trouble sleeping at home. I figured it was my experience in the warehouse, and that I'd be fine if I stuck to my own station. But it wasn't exactly like I was staying up in the Ritz either. My workstation was small, claustrophobic, and deeply depressing. Every time I reported someone for taking too long a break or for slipping something unseen into their pockets, I was reminded of that old man. I checked, and he never came back to work, being marked down as leaving without notice. I've been told people quit the warehouse without telling anyone all the time, but I kept thinking about that box and the strange weight I'd felt trying to push my way past it. I kept wishing that the thought of what was in it would stop bothering me, but it never left. And without realizing why, I found myself Googling Mr. Tatler. Over time, I found versions of him for just about every type of retail worker out there. In almost every story, he was something hidden in a return package sent back to a store to spite workers. But his overall vibe seemed to change from vengeful trickster to malevolent god, depending on who was telling. The closest I got to a physical description was when someone called him a growth, rather than a thing. Although it never exactly said what that growth was. It just resonated with me for some reason, making me think of an old story I read about a girl who never stopped growing and eventually destroys the world. And of course, everyone mentioned how he either lived in or was drawn to broken things. People can be broken too, I thought, when it finally came time to leave. I'd spent all day watching people, like some kind of gargoyle in the rafters, reporting old women for taking too long to get a box off a shelf, seeing people cry in hidden corners while I radioed their boss to give them a row, watching while friends supported each other while I timed them to make sure they didn't take too long to hug a sobbing co-worker. By the time I was walking back through the floor to get to the parking lot, I was thoroughly depressed and just wanted to get back home to sleep. I'd rather be back working in the drive-thru, I thought. No Mr. Tatler there. "Are you broken?" someone said, their raspy voice waking me from my trance. I'd been sulking around with my head hung low and my hands stuffed in my pockets. When I turned, I saw a young man standing at his station, eyes fixed on an empty spot. Nearby, I could hear some gear clicking loudly in protest as something had broken down. A brief second passed, and I realized he was talking to the machine, not me. I nearly laughed at my mistake, except he spoke again. "Are you broken, Alec?" he said, before looking at me with bloodshot eyes. Mr. Tatler lives in Broken Things. Does he live in you? His head turned to the side. Are you a broken thing? What? I stammered. The young man heard me and began to blink. Slowly, he looked around and rolled his shoulders, stretching them. Ah, Christ, he said. The thing's bust. Then, as if seeing me for the first time, he asked, How long have you been there? You aren't going to report me, are you? It's not my fault it broke. No, I said, trying to keep the tremor out of my voice. I'm leaving. I carried on, trying my hardest to keep my eyes on the floor, even as I passed row after row of shelves, their strange shadows doing everything to catch my eye. It's not far, I told myself. Not far, and then I'm out. Are you broken? Someone asked. I jumped and saw a dead-eyed woman glaring at me from a row of shelves. Alec, are you broken? She slipped backwards, and it was like she dissolved into the inky blackness. One second she was there, the next she was gone. Close by, I could hear steps, but were they hers? I stepped forward and fumbled around looking for my phone torch. After a few seconds, I turned it on and revealed nothing but a set of aluminium shelves filled with junk and nothing to note. I went to leave, but was stopped by the sight of a large box sitting plainly in the middle of the floor, lit for all to see by the glaring overhead lights. Not far, I reminded myself. The way out is just around the corner. I just need to get past the box. I took a step, and the box moved. A flap near the top quivered, and that familiar smell flooded the air. I would have retched, but I was paralyzed with fear. Are you broken? Asked a voice. This time wretched and ragged and desperate. Suddenly, the box fell over, and a repulsive stew of bloodied brown oil flooded the floor, foaming as it mixed with dust and debris from a long day's work. I stepped back, but could not stop it breaking against the soles of my shoes. Up ahead lay the overturned box, damp and sagging from its contents. Mr. Tatler lives in Broken Things, said the voice again, and a hand reached out of the darkness within, striking the wet concrete with a loud splat. Mr. Tatler, it cried, the enunciation increasingly distorted. Out of the box slid a naked body, the back glistening with effluent and boils. The skin was raw and pink, like the peeling flesh of a burn victim. In agony, they tried to stand up, but kept slipping and flailing in the slick afterbirth from their nest. They looked like a newborn fawn trying to stand. Looking closer, I realized in horror what was wrong. They were like a half-digested meal. One hand wrapped around their stomach, where I glanced their innards, held inside like stuffing of a teddy bear, and around their jaw and collar muscle, their skin had thinned down to sheer bone, which jutted out from their body like a knife tearing through rubber. Are you broken? He asked, looking at me with just one milky eye bulging loosely from the socket. He tried to stand once more, but fell in the oil, and I winced at the way his soft bones crumpled from the impact. He was sobbing now, but when he looked up, I had a flash of recognition that turned my stomach. It was the old man I'd watched disappear. Are you broken? He pleaded with me, desperation in his voice. Please, he screamed as I turned and ran, terror flooding me at the sound of his manic attempts to follow me. Please, are you broken? Are you broken? Are you broken? Are you broken? I fled, the sound of his voice growing distant. The last thing I heard from him was a sad, resigned admission carried to me and the air as a pathetic whine. Because I was. And with that, there was a loud thunk, a sound that brought sudden darkness and far off cries and confusion. In an instant, the light had gone out, and I stopped still. Some light still filtered through as the odd person used their torches to look around. But all I could see was the disorienting array of shadows and blinding lights too far away to help. Up close, there was nothing but blackness and the sound of my own heart. I couldn't even see my own hands. I turned on my phone light, but could see only a small patch of concrete around me, and the vague sense of nearby shelves and an overhead roof that were little more than blobs in the darkness. I didn't know how far I'd run. I could see nothing of the box, and yet that foul smell still lingered in the air. I was tempted to find it, since the exit was so close by. But the croaking voice of that monstrous, half-eaten thing had left me shaking and barely able to think clearly. Instead, I rushed further into the warehouse, hoping to reach one of the people with torches who could be glimpsed, half seen, through gaps in the shelves. But what followed was like a kind of nightmare. I was utterly lost, unable to see further than a meter or two ahead, like the very darkness itself was being woven around me. Every time I thought I was close, I'd find myself chasing reflections, or the way ahead of me would be blocked by unpassable machines. "Help me!" I cried out to one man I spotted behind some shelves. "Just go around," he replied, gesturing to my right. "It's not far." But when I followed his directions, there was nothing there. And when I looked back, not a second later, he was gone. Only his torch remained, sitting on the ground. I started to panic, and the temptation to crawl into a hole and cry was getting harder to ignore. People were close by, I knew it. But every time I felt like I was getting closer, I'd find myself wandering down dead ends or turning back onto myself. And then, just when I felt like I was getting close enough to reach the busiest part of the warehouse, the sound of hysterical cries filled the air. All around in the darkness, people started shouting, asking questions. "Who's that? Stay there. Don't move. What happened? Was it a machine? An accident? Was someone scared of the dark? Had someone fallen? Keep calm. Someone call the police." All these and more filled the air like distant music. I tried crying out, but it was like the dark was eating my cries. My voice faded to nothing as the clamor grew louder, and if anyone cried out back to me, I couldn't hear. In desperation, I found a wall and slid down against it. Not long after, a terrifying scream of pain rang out from the darkness, and soon there was another. At that point, I couldn't say if it was hysteria or not, but I felt the panic rise. I could hear people running, shouting, yelling. The whole place turned into total mania while I pressed my hands as hard as I could against my ears and tried to block it all out. I screwed my eyes shut when, somehow, I heard the sound of bare feet slapping on concrete. Frantically, I held up my light, but saw nothing except for roaming shadows and playing boxes. Panning the light around, I glimpsed half-open crates and abyssal shadows within them, the strange darkness twisting and dancing. Only the broken see him. "Damn," I cried, waving my phone around desperately, glimpsing a pale face in one of the boxes as I swung around, only to swing back a second later and see a crumpled duvet in the packaging. Another footstep. Who likes to be seen? The words were whispered, as if from above, and I ran without a moment's thought. It wasn't just the sound. It was the tickling breath on the crown of my head. I wasn't even near a wall or any shelves, and the rafters were easily 30 feet above me. "Can you see him?" it whispered again, the hair on my head caressed by the rancid breath. "What the hell is happening?" I wailed, close to a total breakdown. "Lights are back on," someone cried. One by one, the lights came back with powerful ka-thunks, until at last, the one closest to me came on and I was surrounded by light. There was nothing nearby except some boxes, a large conveyor belt, and on the wall opposite me, a blinking camera looking down. Looking at it, something in my head fell into place, like the final piece of a puzzle. There was only one place my cameras couldn't see. I looked up. Behind the lights, hanging low on the wire, was an oblique darkness. I could see structural support beams that held up the enormous roof, the occasional slanted window. Completely dark at this time of night in winter, and thousands of wires, pipes and tubes that carried air, water and light to the whole enormous warehouse. And I saw Mr. Tatler, much the same as I'd seen him that first day, hiding up there where no one even bothers to look. He looked straight back at me, and for a moment I thought he might take me. In one hand, he held that half-eaten man, stroking his glistening bald head like a cat stroking a kitten, before putting him away like a handkerchief. His head tilted, if only for a moment, and I fell backwards under my ass. The sight of him, it was like a painting made of cancer. I couldn't think, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't dare come close to describing him. He was huge. Once, when I was a kid, my dad told me that all us humans are really clinging to the roof of a bottomless abyss. And the next night, I looked up at the stars, and it was so scary I couldn't stop crying. That feeling of insignificance was how I felt looking into Mr. Tatler. Like he was bigger than I could even see or even think. They found me in a crate I'd pulled shut, sobbing. I don't remember it. The last thing I remembered was Mr. Tatler, and then a profound sense of darkness. It felt like a nightmare of being eaten alive, or trapped floating in an alien ocean with nothing but the sense of something giant slithering past your feet. He lives in broken things, and so much around us is clearly broken. I see him everywhere now. He was always there. I just never noticed.